Hey, Bill and Gunn, welcome to Black Law Tribal Edition. Murumu here with you today, and we're looking at the future of technology, in particular digital payments and digital identity. And joining me today is Kydrick from CyberZen, which is a Yidinji company, and proudly here based in the city of Gimoy, and also the key founder and creator of the first ever indigenous computer operating system, which is called CyberZen or Jubu, which is one of those things that you can access the operating system from. It's a walking stick, and you can plug it in and play and go online. And it's made right here on the Yidinji territory. Kydrick, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me back again, Murumu.
Yeah, it's always good to talk technology. A lot of interesting things happening around the world with digital IDs at the moment, and it all is happening. I know that people have digital IDs inside of Australia and Europe and other places are now, it seems that it's going to be, I wouldn't say mandatory, but heavily used around the planet by a majority of all the global citizens. And explain what you know of digital ID in terms of how you see the world using it and being harmonious around the planet in terms of accessing services and financial institutions, making payments, all that kind of stuff.
Well, it's interesting that you say digital ID is not mandatory. At this point in time, we've got an approach that things are optional. Governments are coming on board and saying we should start moving towards having a better digital approval of someone and recognition of them. But if we go back in time, in 2006, there was the first group of people that got together, about 500 people, and said, the internet is broken as it is now. And had we built it properly the first time, the concept of digital identity would be baked into everyone's interaction with it. And from 2000, every 6 months, these 500 people plus more got together and met to form a digital identity type of standard. That's evolved into distributed.identity, and you can have a look at that. And Microsoft Entra is one of the first players out the gate to try and build on that approach. They do things a bit different to what the committee have decided should be done. But ultimately, it's the understanding that it was done wrong the first time and it needs to be corrected and fixed. The challenge point comes to wrestling of control, because the internet as it is now is free. You don't have to pay for it. If you wanted to have it direct access, you can, if you've got the technology to do so. There's no need to have an identity up front. But if you did have an identity up front, do we now get to a enforcement type of situation where private businesses, internet service providers, non-authoritative, non-regulated entities are determining your experience and controlling your life?
And this is what potentially is rolling out already in places. It's all built around safety, or promoted as safety, for digital rights and things like this and people's security. But we know that even on this continent, let's pick on Australia for a little bit, the Medibank scandal, banks, telecommunications operators have been hacked. How safe are these IDs, and why do these hacks or other things compromise these potentially IDs that people are using, for example? And what's going to guarantee that in the future that's not going to happen?
That's kind of a multifaceted question. So the first part is, you know, why are these companies being hacked? And why is hacking now apparently so much more evident than it was even 2 years ago? You can't just say it's because with the advent of COVID, people had a lot more free time on their hands to play with computers. I mean, Netflix shows, they watched a lot of Netflix during that time. So what's happening is a lot of the architecture and design of these larger companies was built 10, 15, 20 plus years ago, where the threat models were much simpler. We didn't have massive botnets that just spun up and brute forced their way through locks and kicked doors down. We didn't have the sophistication that we have today, and we certainly didn't have insanely powerful NVIDIA graphics cards that can run in parallel workloads that you just couldn't dream of back then. So the I would say the companies have not kept up with the current threat models. And just to give you the listeners an understanding, in the last 10 years, NIST, which is the National Institute of Security Technology from the U.S., has logged current common vulnerability exceptions, is what they call them, CVEs. And they have logged...
But these are bad things, right? Or bad agents.
Yeah, so these are effectively what we would call viruses or mistakes in software that can lead to your data walking out the door without you knowing or other nefarious things happening. So control of your computer, for example. Now, there have been, on average, 10 every day. 10 new ones introduced every day for the last 10 years. That level of attack is huge. So you're having to position and defend yourself constantly against 10 new threats. So if you think about if you had 10 new aggressive dogs in the neighborhood every day coming after you, and they don't stop, at some point, one of them's going to get a bite, just on the rule of numbers. This is what's basically been happening with the larger companies, unless they're actively keeping up with it. Now, the second part was the concept of digital identity. How is this protecting us? How is this keeping us safer? I would argue it's not. I would argue that our current instrumental approach that's being rolled out of using biometrics as the key marker of digital identity is not an effective mechanism. Now, you can watch the latest rollout of the orb, the one that scans your eyes and says we use AI to recognize your iris pattern. They actually say in their launch video that all biometrics are useless for identity, but here's our solution using AI. And that's something to go look up on YouTube and watch the video yourself. So if we separate the concept of digital identity from biometrics and from access, then we start to get to a picture of what is intended for identity, not what's currently being rolled out. What's currently being rolled out seems to be more aggressive in restriction, prevention, and, as you mentioned, safety, potentially overarching safety.
Yeah, it's not only computers that can be at risk, it's mobile phone devices, the whole lot. So it's all up for grabs. Just that information on the mobile phones are usually on servers as well. So for people listening out there, they may not truly understand what these things can do, but it's basically jumping into your digital house, your computer or your phone, and taking all your information and then selling that or using it against you. Removing potential money, or there are many other things. Why are people interested in doing that? And what do they gain from getting all these passwords and accounts, and how can they sell that forward, etc.?
There is a huge market for personally identifiable information, and most of it is going to be considered in fraud. Which, you know, there's legislation in place in countries to protect against this. But at the same time, if you don't know it's left your house, how do you know? And it may come to a situation of the first awareness might be a letter in the mail saying, hey, you owe this credit card company who you've never had a credit card with a very large sum of money. And at that point, what do you do? How do you address that situation? The horse is bolted.
Or even more common now is people ringing you up, finding out your phone and your personal details, and then confirming that with you, and then asking you or letting you know that there might have been a change in security and they have to change their password, and they provide all those new details. And, of course, they provide the old ones first for these people to actually log in and then change everything, and then they steal the identity.
This is actually that's a very accurate and very realistic situation. So we've had reported to us a particular situation where a group have gone to government digital identity access, and they've contained enough information to seize control of, these are government accounts, so these are tax-linked accounts, Medicare-linked accounts in the nation of Australia or equivalent in other nations, where they've centralized access to these other services. And these groups have wrestled control from the authorized individual to themselves, and then they've gone and, in that same situation, reauthorized. So they've gone and set a voice print, they've gone and set new recovery details, they've gone and changed all the information, but they've still left, like, the mailing address to the old mailing address, so the liability is not with them, And they've literally seized the control, changed the account, and things like tax returns have gone astray.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm trying to think of, let's say I had a government ID of some sort from around the world, and that was online. Someone rings me up and says, oh, we're from this department. We just want to confirm there's been some mistake or overpayments in your account. We just want to make sure that it's you're the correct person. Can you provide me with your name and your date of birth details and confirm that with me? Most people will do it because they're used to doing that. But this is how scammers and hackers can really not only do that by phone, but they could probably do that by some sort of AI-generated voice now, where you're prompted to type in or to say your details, and then that goes back into their control, and then they can cause a bit of havoc from there.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, so there's a, you know, the most common situation in the world is someone calls you and says, hey, I'm calling from such and such an authoritative place, and they sound authoritative on the phone, and then they go, are you such and so? And the most natural answer people do is yes. Now, you can go back many years, and what would this is an old attack. What people would do is they would record the yes in your voice, and then they would do something like phone up, get a phone contract, and they take it out over the phone. They play the terms and conditions, and to issue the contract, they just need the verbal yes. Well, they just play your voice at that point in time, and now they've got full authorization. They take that to court, and the court goes, it's your voice, isn't it? And you go, it sounds like me. that's a very old attack. It's been happening for quite some time. What we have today is AI has become sufficiently advanced that with 30 seconds of recording, you can reproduce someone's voice reasonably accurate to a point where a human would struggle, very much struggle to differentiate. And you can take that voice, you can apply emotion to it, and you can switch language on it. So you may find that someone could find themselves in a situation saying things in another dialect, taking out contracts in another dialect, and they may never even know they were used in fraud.
I've seen some videos on the internet about that. A famous actor, for example, I can't remember who it was, but they recorded the voice, and you can type or what you want that voice to say. But this is next level stuff. And I don't think a lot of mob, indigenous peoples around the continent are up to scratch on it, because it is quite a highly advanced operation. And you're saying companies are struggling, but even governments, when it comes to legislation, are struggling to keep up with modern day technology because it's constantly changing. How can people look after themselves and not be victims to these types of scams?
It's where it starts getting tricky, and everyone has to work out their own risk model. So if you're building a house and you're in a floodplain, you're going to potentially think about the house going underwater. That might be something you think about. If you're building a house where the earth can slip out from under the footings, you're probably going to put deeper footings down. It's about understanding your situation, and everyone's situation is different. We can't say anything that would work for everybody. Now, that being said, there are some really sound pieces of advice that have stood the test of time. One of those pieces of advice that I was told a number of years ago is to contact every company that you have a service provision with, mobile phone companies, utility companies, governments even, and to say, can you bring up the notes on my file? And they go, yep, sure, no problem, because they all keep notes. And then for every single provider to think of a massively embarrassing word that whoever says that word is going to turn bright pink, and something you would not necessarily want to say when you're on a phone call in a government office or a corporate office. And to get them to put that word as a note on the file to authorize they are from that company. So if you ever receive a phone call from a company, you go, please read out the authorization word I've given you before we continue. Because right now we have a lot of companies saying we need to prove who you are, but there's got to be proof of who the company is.
And they may have to say I am sexy or something like that. That's a bit out of the box to verify whatever the word is that you give them.
I would go much worse. The advice I was told was literally think of the most embarrassing word that you would never really say and have a different one for each provider so you can know that a person has said that because a machine has no tone or emotion to it. So if it's a, if it's something you're not normally going to say in public, then they really do want to contact you for a really good reason.
You're listening to Black Law Tribal Edition. My guest today is Kydrick from Cybersyn, which is a Yidinji company that makes computer operating systems and other technology, which we're going to delve into today. We're talking about some of the dangers of, I guess, of a real-world experience now with digital IDs and telephones, mobile phones and computers, how these things are being monitored and potentially attacked, and some of the just basic things that we're sort of talking about today of trying to see where it's all going. Knowing this, though, Kydrick, the Yidinji operating system and the Yidinji future is built to minimize this type of attack or accident, whatever it may be. What's different between the Yidinji operating system and all the operating systems currently in the world that are available to the average punter out there? And try and keep it, you know, explain it in a way that's quite easy for us to explain, because I know it can be tough, but you've done a good job so far.
So there's a phrase that's used in Yidinji, and I've heard it used a few times. If the tree is rotten, cut it to where it's not rotten. And sometimes that might be to a little tiny piece of the root, depending on the situation, so that it may regrow appropriately. Cybersyn had the idea that you should own your data. It should be able to be owned by you. Now, there's three massive requirements to actually own something.
Okay, now we're getting to, I'm going to cut you off there. What do you mean by own? Because if does the average person out there own their data or not?
No, they don't.
So can you explain that?
Yeah. So trying to not get too caught up in it, and obviously this is not legal advice, go take this up with your IP lawyer if you have an IP protection lawyer. If you're an artist, go have those conversations with whoever's issuing the copyright. If something is made to be protected as intellectual property, then it's generally registered. But you don't have to, right? There's options in courts to not do that. But if there was a dispute against the authorship or ownership of that, then you have to have some evidence to prove that it's yours. So traditionally, if you were to, say, write a book, you would write your first manuscript by hand, and you'd scribble it, and you'd have this big pile, and then that would be your first draft, and then you'd go through several iterations. You may even submit that first draft to a publisher for initial reading or get feedback. In today's world, that first draft tends to be put into typed into a computer. Now, to prove if there was a discrepancy on ownership, you would bring out that first draft and the court would say, well, that's your handwriting. That's on your ink. We can validate by carbon dating the date of when it was written. It's obviously yours. And any other fake copy would be newer, slightly different, and be able to be disproven. Because of computers, that first draft exists entirely in what's called RAM on the computer. It's temporary. And when you click the save button, you're actually saving a copy of the first draft. And the first draft is gone when you close the program or reboot the computer. So you don't have proof of authorship anymore. That's the situation we're saying fundamentally is causing problems.
So if you're listening out there and you're a songwriter and you're using the computer to write your songs, I mean, obviously a good way to do that is actually write it by hand first, if possible. I mean, some people can't, you know, for whatever reason. Keep that original copy for yourself. Once you put it on a computer, then it's
a copy. Really,
it's a copy, and it's not the original. And that's what we're talking about today, and little simple things like that. But so when we're coming back to personal data now, mm-hmm. that could be for everything, not just a book. Yep. It could be for your medical records or the medical records that you're using.
Yep.
Who owns that? All those things are what the world's trying to talk about. Data sovereignty, for example.
So there's the phrasing usus, fructus, abundus. Those are the three phrases that typically people consider as part of ownership. So you must be able to prove that you have the ability to control something, to benefit from it by control. You must be able to prove that you could create it, and you must be able to prove that you have the ability to destroy it, abandon it, or render it null. Those things are very challenging to do. And if you think about the things that are within your hand, even the things in your hand might be difficult to say, I can do that to all three things to them at all times. So this is where, when CyberZen says we went to the concept of you own your data, we mean all those three pieces are in place and provable at all times. So it doesn't matter if the data you've created is on your computer, or it's on someone else's computer, or it's stored somewhere in the cloud or somewhere else, you have the ability to control it at all times.
It's got your digital fingerprint on it.
Yes.
So no one can claim at first that even though it's on a computer, it will always be yours because your digital fingerprint is on there, right?
Yes. Yes. And this ability allows us to do several things. It allows us to even a playing field when you're talking one person to another person. This is mine. This is yours. I now choose to give you permission to use some of this or some of that, and you're going to give me something back for that. I can't just go, in good faith, I've taken it because I read it.
And correct me if I'm wrong here, but that digital fingerprint we're talking about, like in other places, I might create that digital fingerprint for you to use, but I control it. And that's where the confusion can be. I'm going to let you use this digital fingerprint, which is yours, to access what's on the system, but you don't own that digital fingerprint. I own it because I made it.
Yeah. This is where it starts to become blurry, particularly when we have the concept of where identification is a document, identification is you, what's the line between them. So from a digital identity perspective, now CyberZen, our tagline is responsibility is power. That's our tagline. So the more you're prepared to be personally, individually responsible and accept responsibility in this world, the more CyberZen can grant you what you're seeking. In terms of that sense. And we're talking about for the good of all of us, right? We're not talking about I want to sleep with more women or I want to sleep with more men. It's about responsibility working with power. So when you talk about digital identity being given to you by, say, a government or a company, then they've created it. They hold the keys to it. They're giving you permission to use the key. Now, if I walk through a door and every time I walk through the door, it says, G'day, and says my name. Well, it's actually said g'day to the key because I've used the key to open the door. But how many times do I go through the door before I think it's welcoming me just because the name is the same name that I've got? And that's where the confusion starts to turn up. So we need to keep in our minds that digital identification is owned by the one who issued it. You're given permission to use it to access their technology, their property, and their systems. When you have your own data, you need to be able to isolate those two into separate locations.
Yeah, it's a very good explanation. And I think once people start to see what the Dingy Nation is doing, it's actually handing back the responsibility, as you're saying, to the individual if they want that. Not everyone wants that. We understand that. But if people are, for example, if you've got family histories and cultural stories, songlines, songs that you want to pass on to your children or their children's children, then this is where it gets very, very interesting, because if you're going to put that on a cloud on another computer, it's not a CyberZen one, for example, then that's not really your information anymore. Mm. It's accessible to you, yes, but you're just holding the copyright for it. Even though your family and your ancestors are the one that created that or kept the song alive, for example, the recording of it is not yours. And that's really important, because I think that's when people start to realize that. And that's why in the Yidinji government office we have these microphones here, is because people can come and record their oral histories and we make a copy for them to keep. And then we delete the one that we have on our system. So it's up to you then to keep that information alive and whatever it may be, because it's none of our business, but we just want to help people maintain those things if they want to. But that's the same concept behind what CyberZen's doing and the operating system, is that that's your private bank. Whatever you do in there, CyberZen can't even look in there because we designed the computer like that, right?
That's correct. CyberZen can't access your data at all. We cannot build facility or functionality to do so. We're completely unable to by our own design. So it's yours, and it's entirely yours. We don't care. We don't want to know. We shouldn't know, because it's like language. You can't own the language. It's used by everyone. So this is used for your use, your property. The other thing to be aware of there is it's now become a standard internationally amongst larger companies that if they find something in their cloud storage, so they are required to scan their cloud storage. It's part of their legal requirements. If they find something that may disagree with their terms and conditions or their current changed opinion, because these large companies do change their opinions based on who's currently in power, what the majority of people are thinking, or which one's going to have the least litigation, then their modus operandi today is to delete that. So if you turn up to one of the cloud storage and you find that your song is missing, well, you've got no comeback on it. But at the same time, they're justified in deleting it.
You're listening to Black Law Tribal Edition right across the planet today, thanks to the Yidinji Broadcast Service and our friends at Bumabipra Media, 98.7 FM. If you're listening inside of Australia, it's via the National Indigenous Radio Service. We'll be back after the break.
Hello, my name is Andrew, and I'm from Arnhem Land. My band called Andrew Guru Band, and you're listening to BBM 98.7.
Yeah, welcome back to the show. We've got Kydrick today to talk about a lot of things that are happening in the future and happening right now, actually, in terms of artificial intelligence, digital ID, data sovereignty. Kydrick is the creator of Cyberzen, which is Yidinji operating system. It's the very first Indigenous nation operating system made that we know of around the world, and we're very, very proud of that. Happy to have you here, Kydrick, again. Let's talk about the future of money now, because I know that a lot of people would have heard of digital wallets. People can pay now using a Westpac or a Commonwealth Bank. Let's say they got some sort of app on their phone that interacts with the BEX system, I think it's called in Australia, which is nearly 30 years old. Now, by 2030, which is in 5 years, they're moving away from that system because it's quite old. What are the positive sides of streamlined payment systems and things like that, apart from the immediate transaction ability? Is that going to make economies and governments and things much more stronger, pardon me?
I'm not quite sure what you mean.
Will it make it easier for everybody? Or will it be still full with problems?
A convenience is always better. In the majority of people's situation, convenience is better. You have you get one dishwasher, and it's sort of benefit maybe, but then you tend to forget to put it on for a few days and it doesn't always come out clean. But if you get two dishwashers, you now don't have any storage cupboards in the house. You just have one permanent clean cupboard of dishes. And it's that balance of, well, at what point does convenience now become actually usable? So when we introduced credit cards as nations and merchant facilities many years ago, the ATMs were unreliable. They didn't put out the right amount of cash. Sometimes things went missing. Sometimes international transfers were intercepted and changed or rerouted. And these are the concerns of, well, we should digitize everything. We should make it super secure. But as you pointed out, these systems are 30 plus years old. They were not designed to handle, one, the volume of what's going through them now, and two, the concept of even the thought of what we can attack them with today. So the other part is the cost of sending money. So for example, if we were in Africa, it can cost around, if you're sending $200, it might be $50 in bank fees just to send that money through, passing through several countries to reach your relative.
Well, we can even go one better. If you're up in Cape York and you wanted to fax money through the post office, you're going to pay an extra $20 on top of that. That's just to fax someone some money to another post office where they can confirm that and pay it out. So these things now, well, those transaction fees and everything associated with it, reduce or would be constantly, you just never know.
Absolutely. And this is where we're seeing people not care about the safety of the technology and start using stable coins, because the fees are significantly lower to go into and out of a stablecoin environment than it is to pay the fax fee.
So someone might, like a stablecoin, might be able to use Bitcoin and a few other things out there that people might have heard of. The average person might have heard of Bitcoin or this digital money that's out there called stablecoin. What are some of the things that aren't good about those?
Well, the fact you mentioned Bitcoin, that would be a good stablecoin. A stablecoin that's pinned to something of actual recognition is good, but we have stablecoins today which are pinned to inflation against the US inflation index. So they're saying our stablecoin will remain stable provided the US keeps getting more into debt. That's kind of a concerning coin if you think about it logically. But the rates on that may be incredibly low if you're going in and going out. But then the other part of that is the concept of blockchain itself, because stablecoin is a subcategory of blockchain. It's using the same technology. So if you've heard of Bitcoin, it's a variation of Bitcoin-type technology that allows stablecoin to work. This is now a permanent record accessible to anyone. There is no protections on it, and this is where I get companies talk to me and say, well, we've invented this or we've invented that to protect our chain. Unless the chain is private, then the chain is publicly recognizable and trackable and monitorable. And this is not unknown. There are articles from 3 years ago. There's a NYM white paper, NIM, it's pronounced NYM, white paper. Listeners can look that up, which explains the security level of blockchains quite clearly. There are other articles that were released in recent as March this year, where they go through and they explain the security of blockchain in great detail and where you should be concerned about using it.
If we can explain or say that blockchain is like a big highway with six lanes on it, then there's you got to get onto that and then get off that road at some point in time. That's where these stable coins and other digital things can plug into that system. So in that sense then, you mentioned that blockchains can be vulnerable in terms of not being private. So can they be hacked or shut down? Or what happens if the blockchain goes down, for example?
Well, blockchain is a currency, recognized as a currency now. It's fairly normal for most people to accept some form of blockchain as businesses and even as now governments, because we've now, if you've been following what the US has been doing, there's the CLEAR legislation and the GENIUS legislation, which now effectively says all USDT, all US-backed stablecoins are under the influence of the US should they choose to wish them to be. So that starts opening up a whole different ballgame. There's also been discussions of mandatory registration of blockchain and stablecoins and these type of technologies from the beginning of next year. And this includes Australia as one of the countries that's put forth legislation for that, as long as many countries in Europe and the US and others. So the concern becomes, well, one, how do I get onto it? And how do I get off it? That's convenient now. We have exchanges that are backed by governments to trade their local currency for these tokens. And that comes with all the reporting requirements of those things.
Yeah, the Reserve Bank of Australia has announced, I think it's Project Acacia. I could be wrong about that, but anyway, they're already looking at these things. And that's good. Like, it's good to explore technologies, but why is Edinji's technology different to blockchain, and what are the benefits of that? Because this is where I think it's very important that people realize what we're doing here. Blockchain is useful. You use it like a tool. But if it becomes vulnerable, we need to fall back onto a Edinji technology that's going to be long-lasting, private, and secure.
Yes. So this is where there's fundamental difference. We've been talking about the future of money, future currency. Currency is a transactional-based approach. You need to have that transaction in place, and that meets the definitions of currency. There's a technology that's been developed here, which Cybersyn has access to, and that technology works on the concept of deeds and settlements. So it's not transactional. It's deeds and settlements. It's quite a different basics. It does not use blockchain.
Okay. Can you explain the deed as opposed to some sort of transaction? So the third party, all that kind of stuff.
Yes. So a transaction is two records, two ledgers side by side. And whenever something leaves one ledger, it shows up on the other ledger.
So let's go, we go down to the shops. Mm-hmm. You pull out your card. You pay $5. That $5 goes to somewhere and then ends up on Woolies ledger there somewhere.
Eventually, yeah. It'll go through. The reality is it goes through the merchant facility, and then it goes through its ledgers to its ledgers to its ledgers. And that's why it takes time, because they may also hold on to it to check anti-money laundering and other processes in place. That's their prerogative as legislated by the owner of the currency.
So why is a deed or a settlement different to this, if you can explain that for the audience?
So a deed is something of value. A deed has to be made. You can't say, I've got a tree sitting in the backyard and I'm gonna give you the right to, when the tree falls over, do something with it. That's not gonna help, right? That you're gonna watch the tree and hope it falls over so you can cash out on its benefit. What a deed is for something to have value in this world, there are three things that must be in place. The thing must be qualifiable, quantifiable, and have a measure of resilience. Now, to explain each of those words so we can converse, to be qualifiable, it has to have a measure of effort and extraction. So man has to take a resource that's available naturally and work on it. You have to input labor to get something out of it. So this is the creation of art.
So yeah, let's use a mango tree, for example.
Well, that's relatively easy. You walk up and you grab it off the mango. And that's the effort put in, right? You've taken the resource, the mango, but it's useless until you take it off the tree. At that point, it's now got some value. But then you must be quantifiable. So to be quantifiable, you have to be able to measure the amount of resource that has to be dug through and the amount of labor that has to be put in to get that thing of value. Well, from a mango tree example, you don't have to go through many mango trees to find a mango. But if there's a mango at the very top of the tree, it's going to take a bit more effort. But you would average all that out and to work out in how many hours can you pick so many mangoes per area. And then you've got a repeatable value. But then you've got the resiliency, which is how long before it returns to a state of chaos. Well, for a mango, that might be, depending on how ripe it is, not long at all. But for something that's like metal taken from the ground, so say iron is going to resist returning to an eroded state for a certain amount of time. So we can naturally say, well, it takes more effort and more work to extract iron, and it's going to hold that for a longer period of time than a mango would. So an iron would be worth more value than a mango, even though one fills your belly and one doesn't. So that's the understanding of value. And once you have an understanding of value, you can now point a deed to that thing of value. The deed is only really in existence until it returns to its state of chaos. So more valuable items are going to be better to have against the deed than less valuable items. So it would not make sense, and I think even common sense would prevail amongst our listeners, to not issue deeds against mangoes.
Yeah, so like maybe the milk is about to go off in the shops, so they make it half price or something like that. It's because they know it's going to lose its value soon.
Exactly. So that's a deed. So it's effectively, you can say, art. And one of the phrases Syversen says is the only thing mankind is capable of producing is art. So we take the natural thing, we make it into some form of art that could be clothes, that could just be a sofa to sit on or a chair to sit on or even just a stool. But that's been modified, that now has value because it's got all the requirements, qualifiable, quantifiable, and resilient. So when you have a deed, and this is where you could say, well, I want to actually start to register my deeds. I want to put serial numbers on them and hold a global register where I can now track the history of what's happened to that thing over time. Then that's a whole different ballgame, but we'll talk about that another time. Then you can now say, I've got my proof of it. This is the proof that this thing is real. This is the proof that this thing is had value produced and it's actually of value. And now I'm going to settle that with you right now for something else. So think about it as if I'm going to someone's house to buy a chair, I'm going to say, well, I'd like your chair. And they go, well, this chair is not stolen. This is my record that this chair has come to me in good faith, clean, and I'm able to pass it on to you. I didn't borrow it from my neighbor and forget to return it, and it just happened to end up in your truck. So then when you say, well, I'm now going to give you something else of value in exchange for that, the settlement is the record that both those have been exchanged and the deed potentially swapped over.
So the one becomes the holder of the property then, and they've exchanged that, as opposed to the money goes from here to there, and then they receive the product.
Yes. Yeah, and the ownership is quite different too. The creator of the currency owns the currency at all times. So in a transactional-based system, you're saying, well, I'll take my promise to exchange for your promise, and we'll swap the property, hoping those promises hold. Whereas when you've done a deed and settlement, it's done at that point. It's now provable at court that this has happened. You can't undo it.
Yeah, and the good book says that what is bought by the slave is owned by the master. Or there is a saying about that. I'm not too sure if it's in the scriptures, but what is bought by the slave is owned by the master is one of the maxims or that we hear about in the legal circles. So you can see how it works there. I'm just thinking now, how does I know that you're coming across some other technology and things that you're experimenting with at the moment, and that is some sort of digital platform where people can conduct these types of trade in the future. What's your concept of that? You don't have to talk about what you're doing now, but what is the concept of that space?
So if you're prepared to work in a deed and settlement approach, you have different options than if you're working in a transaction.
Let's say you're an Indigenous artist and you're making mm-hmm. paintings.
Sure. So as an Indigenous artist, you go, okay, I've made my painting. I've got the video recording of me making it. That's pretty good. So that's some good evidence there. Yep. You've got maybe two or three other friends who go, I'm going to stand up and say, I agree. This is yours. You made it. I'm going to put my word behind it, because you know, the Bible does say, out of the mouth of two or three witnesses, let a thing be established. So you now have you choose to register that with a serial number that gets put into a global registry of property that's accessible to prove anything. And you then attach that registration number to your painting. So now anyone who holds that painting forever can now go and see the history of it. You know, how many times has it changed hands? Has it been had maintenance work done on it? Has it been restored?
But unlike the private blockchain, which is a superhighway, this is your own private dirt track.
Yep.
That you can let people know about, and at every stop that you can see who's visited and who's taken on that painting. So it might have been sold and traded 15 times, but along that private dirt track, you can see where those exchanges took place, but no one else can.
Correct. You can see that the exchange happened. You may not see what the value of the exchange was, because that's private between the one who brought it and the one who sold it. But you can see that it did change hands. You may also not see who it went to, because again, that's private to the one who brought it and to the one who sold it. It's no one else's business. But you can know that it happened. So where this starts to become very beneficial to understand today is if we had a car. So a manufacturer makes a car, and the manufacturer sells the car. Now, when you buy a secondhand car, you've always got questions. And those questions, particularly if you're a woman buying a secondhand car, has this car been looked after properly? Is the mechanic taking me for a ride because they don't think I know about vehicles? Well, if this registration has happened, then everything that's happened to that vehicle can now be attached to it and sealed with the seal of the one who worked on it. So you can now go, the car went to get history, and say the car breaks down in the middle of the road, and when they look into it, they go, well, the last service wasn't done properly on this vehicle. There's damage that shouldn't have been there. Now you have grounds to go back to the one who signed off saying they did it and say, what did you do? Because my property's now been damaged. So you get a different benefit to what you have available today.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And I think, is there a need for this? I mean, obviously, the banking industry is one I can see this very much being applied to, or finances. But this can be for anything, like you said. It could be for an artwork or cars. Mm-hmm. But it's different technology that, like I said, blockchain is useful and it's convenient. But this is a lot more private and secure. And what are your guarantees as the one that created it that has benefits that this other world that we're talking about now, the blockchain world and the public world, can't promise?
So this is where, you know, I'm a founder of CyberZen. There's several of us founders that we all decided to found this direction and change in technology that you can own your own data. This particular technology has applications where blockchain is a very good platform if you want something to be public record. And that's where blockchain stands very strongly. The other place where blockchain stands strongly is if you can maintain that 51% guarantee. So blockchain is now recognized globally as a critical infrastructure service. If more than 51% of the nodes providing a chain went down, that chain becomes unreliable and has to be voided. You can't actually prove its authority anymore. But that also means that adoption of blockchain, which is designed fundamentally, so that's the Bitcoin variations of blockchain are designed for currency. The Ethereum variations of blockchain are designed for smart contracts. So they're designed for different things. Now, contracts being made public, that's a business's decision to make. There may be benefit to doing that in some cases. There may be benefit to not doing that. But that's just to keep in mind. They have different purposes.
Well, it's not beneficial if a hacker got it and exposed it or had access to these things. That's where we're talking about servers and system being minimizing the hackability of what we're trying to build here.
Absolutely. And this is where, if we were to say a blockchain is going to replace cash as a digital currency, this is where I'm going to stand firm on, and Cybersyn stands firm on this. That's not technologically possible. And this is in conflict to what a lot of other people are saying. But the reality of it is, cash is not public record of everything that happened, whereas blockchain is. So you're facing a dilemma of, well, where's my privacy? What if I wanted to give money to my ailing mother and I didn't want the rest of my family to know about that? Well, in a blockchain-based world, if your family had the influence, they would go, hey, you gave money to her. Does this now make us have to give money? And there's all these other questions that can be brought up when you have a public record of everything that's happened. Cybersyn's technology is first and foremost designed to work offline. We do not require this technology of deeds and settlements does not require the internet. It does not require any network at all. It can literally be three people standing in the middle of a field can now exchange that property and settle it.
Yeah, and you know, blockchain is pseudo-anonymous in that it can be sort of unseen, but ultimately it can be broken into, whereas cash is the true anonymity because you can give someone cash and no one knows about it. That's why I guess these movies with the mafia and everything, these suitcases of cash that they give to people. I think from where we're heading as a nation, the Yidinji Nation, we want to encourage ethical trade and commerce. And if we're going to be talking about data sovereignty and this, that, and the other, then we're going to have to walk the walk as well as talk the talk. And that's what we're doing right now.
Absolutely. And this is where Cybersyn's technology for deeds and settlements is available within Cybersyn. You can't publicly just walk up and say, I want to use it. You've got to be responsible. It's, you know, we say responsibility is power. So you've got to accept responsibility to have access to this tech. The Yidinji Nation is, as far as I'm aware, actively seeking to work out what a true cash replacement would be, to find the balance of what SID can and can't do, and the situations where does SID need to be available in a fully offline environment? Does SID need to be available in an emergency situation? And these are the questions that Yidinji is discussing, which, to our knowledge, other nations are still glossing over.
Yes. Kydrick, thank you so much. I know it's one of those things that it can be difficult to describe because it is the unseen world. We're not looking at our computer screens and all that stuff. So thank you so much for coming on today. And that brings an end to Black Law Tribal Edition today. We'll be back with normal programming in terms of the usual suspects, Ganyara, Yurlam, Bumi, and the others that usually jump on. And thank you so much, Gayabara Galanida. May God's peace be upon you wherever you are listening to the program. We'll catch you next week. Galing. Yeah.
country's language and you can find that person because country talks back. Now, if you don't know that connection between language and country, it makes it very difficult to have that association. Once we had done putting Wagamay language back on country, it had a huge impact not only on us as custodians of this country, because it's part of our healing process and connecting us and identifying, but also it was an opportunity for white people to then tap into this history, this wealth of history of knowledge of country.
You see, I'm scoped from afar, some just mind on biz. Some people reaching for the stars, others reaching for their kids. Many never saw the sails or smoke trails and did a bit. Now they trapped in a dead world, hoping to make it big. A lot to drop a track at summertime and summer clear vids. Cause the summary is killing me and someone did a shit. Somebody better call the cavalry, cause someone trying to live. They need a sunken treasure, suddenly their son is on the hit. Their gun is on the hip with money on the clip. This ain't funny, in an insane world they want us to be living in, man. Every goose got their beacon, in it. Meantime, truth they be.